of a company or family. The president shouldn't preside, be above or to the side of the fray, the action, but reside, be in the middle with the rest of us, suffering or prospering alongside. 'Cause no matter what level of in charge you are, there's always so much you and no one can control. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 22nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, ideas, and so forth at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Frida Ross, Alex Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Jill Frey, and the director of Evening News, our own Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our great members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and now is a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go online to bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, and have a good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about the newest article they co-authored for the paper. It's called A Tragic Comedy of Errors. Rapid Response BioClean asks court to set aside wrongful death lawsuit ruling, in part because its owner and attorney forgot about the case. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. So your newest piece covers this wrongful death lawsuit against Rapid Response BioClean. That's in the death of Debbie Ann Beaver. To start, let's do a little bit of table setting, if you don't mind. For folks who may not know, what does Rapid Response BioClean do, and what was this lawsuit about?
Yeah, Rapid Response BioClean is the city's primary private contractor to sweep homeless encampments. So essentially the city gives them locations to go and post notice that they're going to remove the camp, and then Rapid Response will go back out at some point and order everybody to leave. And they take what is left behind or what people are asking them to store, ideally, and dispose of trash, or at least what Rapid Response has termed as trash. This lawsuit stems from a death in 2019 of Debbie Ann Beaver, who was a 57-year-old homeless Portlander. According to the complaint in the case, Rapid Response BioClean took her medication during a sweep on July 16th, 2019, or in some sort of action on part of the city. And then 8 days later, Debbie passed away, and the Rapid Response found her unresponsive on July 24th, 2019. And again, according to the complaint, failed to offer or render aid in that instance. And so the Beaver Estate is suing, or sued successfully at this point, Rapid Response BioClean for wrongful death.
Right. And so then to continue the thread, Rapid Response never responds to the lawsuit, ironically to its name, and that ends up resulting in a default judgment. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So, and that is an important distinction. They were not found guilty, but they were, they lost the lawsuit via default judgment, like you pointed out, which is something that the plaintiff can request in the event that the defendant does not respond to a case in a certain amount of time. They don't show up to court. They don't respond with any filings. They don't respond to the complaint in any way. The plaintiff can then essentially ask the judge to rule in favor of the plaintiff so the case doesn't just stay open forever. That is what happened in this instance. The rapid response did not respond. Michael Fuller, the attorney for the Beaver State, did ask the judge to enter a default ruling against Rapid Response, which she did, and that was signed January 26th of 2022, so a little over 2 years ago.
And so could you take me through the timeline of the filing, the summons, each step in this process that results in the default judgment?
Yes. So Fuller, on behalf of the Beaver family, essentially filed a notice in the summer of 2021 that they were going to be filing a lawsuit against Rapid Response for this. They did ultimately file that lawsuit in August of 2021. So through Rapid Response's registered agent, which is essentially a company that they pay to take in legal documents and things like that, Rapid Response was served with a summons to respond to the complaint in September of 2021. They did not respond to it. It was in the media and things like that. Again, there was no response from Rapid Response. So in December of 2021, Fuller entered a motion for default judgment. And then the next month, Judge Judith Matarazzo signed that default judgment, essentially saying that Rapid Response had lost the lawsuit because it did not respond to it. Then later in June of 2022, a judge ordered Rapid Response to pay the Beaver State $45,000 and 9% annual interest. There was nothing that happened between then and April when Tara Bennett found this case in the court records and began asking around about it. She asked the city, she asked Rapid Response. Rapid Response did not respond to us, but the city did question Rapid Response about it, which initially is when Rapid Response said they found out about the lawsuit to begin with, which I'm sure we'll talk about that in a second. That story has now changed, but they do maintain that's when they first found out that a default ruling was entered in this case.
What a web. Well, we're sitting here almost 2 years later, and Rapid Response wants to bring the issue back to court and reverse the default judgment. What gives them the grounds to do that?
Like I alluded to, the story has now changed from Rapid Response. Initially, when they were going to ask the court to vacate that ruling and kind of start from square one with this lawsuit, the main argument from Rapid Response, including the owner, Lance Hamill, and its attorney, Amber Beyer, as well as actually the owner of JDM, Jonathan Mishkin is his name. JDM is Rapid Response's registered agent. So all three of them essentially submitted statements, or should have submitted statements. Again, I'm sure we'll get to that in a second. Essentially saying they'd never heard of the lawsuit, that summons and complaint was in fact served to Rapid Response's agent, JDM, which court records confirm, but that an error from somebody in JDM staff resulted in neither JDM's owner or Rapid Response or Rapid Response's attorney ever hearing about this lawsuit. After some depositions in the case in which the Beaver family's attorney, Michael Fuller, pressed the parties and said, hey, you know, essentially, we know that you know about it, or at least you should be. That confidence that Fuller had caused Rapid Response's owner to look back through his emails, at which point he found that he was in fact notified of the case by the attorney, Amber Beyer, by his own attorney, in communication where she sent a copy of the lawsuit to their insurance company. and CC'd Hamill on that. And you know, simply put, Hamill and Beyer both completely forgot about the lawsuit and never received that summons that was served a couple months later to JDM. Essentially, what they're arguing in court is something called excusable negligence. So, you know, something happened, it's, you know, per their argument, that stopped them from being able to respond to this lawsuit. Again, initially, that argument was based on the idea that they'd never heard of it until April of this year, which now that part of the story has changed. Whether a judge will agree that that is enough to vacate a ruling and start from scratch is currently unknown.
You may not have the answer to this question, and if you don't, that's totally okay. But how common is it that a default judgment on an issue like this, when we're talking about a major city contractor like Rapid Response BioClean, that a default judgment where, you know, they just didn't respond or say they didn't know about it, how often does something like that happen?
Well, I mean, I don't know that, you know, statistically. I know that it's not it's not terribly common, right? That somebody says, hey, I didn't know I was being sued, so we have to start over. There is precedent for it in the law, and Oregon's law is pretty clear in kind of erring on the side of giving somebody their day in court. So, and that's certainly what the defendant's Rapid Response are arguing in this case, is that, you know, state law is on their side. The possible hurdle that they have is excusable negligence, right? You know, did they do due diligence despite knowing about the case, even if they didn't get that summons? You know, those are the things that the judge is going to weigh in making that decision. And it is very subjective, I think, and it's not, there isn't a great, even from, you know, their own filings, there isn't really a one-to-one where, hey, we forgot and we didn't get one thing in this process, but we knew about it and forgot. So it really, yeah, it's going to be up to a judge.
Well, it's very interesting also, as you note in the piece, that they found out about it from Street Roots Inquiry.
Yeah, they did apparently find out about the default judgment after Street Roots had contacted the city asking for a comment on it. You know, we can't confirm that that's the case, but that is one of the statements that was made to the court.
So where is this process at now?
Well, you know, there's certainly, I think, some legal strategy to be played out here between both sides, as you know, I think like these amended statements and in fact the original response and original statements weren't filed until last week. It's unclear why Rapid Response was not able to successfully submit those documents until last week, but it remains to be seen how a judge is going to respond now that the general kind of you know, the like kind of foundation of this argument has changed. If things proceed, both sides will go to a show cause hearing in which Rapid Response's attorneys will present their evidence for why this ruling should be thrown out and this lawsuit should be relitigated. And of course, the plaintiff's attorneys will get to argue against Rapid Response's assertion that there was some excusable negligence here.
Well, this isn't the first time that Rapid Response has lost in a lawsuit related to its conduct. Could you talk me through some of those other instances?
Yeah, this will actually be at least the third lawsuit in the last 2 years that Rapid Response will be on the losing end of, the unfavorable end of. There was an incident in which a couple had their possessions thrown away by Rapid Response, and the court deemed that it was done so improperly. They received really small settlements last year. We're talking, you know, a few hundred dollars to kind of replace the materials that were disposed of. A few years ago, you weren't really seeing these lawsuits being lost by Rapid Response. So it is a bit of a shift now, and why that figure of three in the last 2 years is a notable kind of development. But yeah, I mean, all of these lawsuits and certainly a lot of complaints that were reported on last week by Tara Bennett at Tree Roots, you know, they're just, all of it is really surrounding kind of the way that rapid response handles people's belongings, and whether or not that's in line with city code, whether or not that's legal. Yeah, it's definitely a shifting landscape, I think, right now.
Well, to that point, are the practices that led to this wrongful death suit and the other lawsuits that Rapid Response has lost, are those practices still happening from what we know?
Yeah, I mean, Rapid Response has yet to my knowledge, acknowledge any wrongdoing in any of these cases. And certainly the city has not, you know, pointed to even, you know, these kind of smaller points where Rapid Response was found to have done something unlawful. You know, I don't think either the city or Rapid Response is really at this point willing to, or at least publicly of the opinion that they've done anything wrong. So I, you know, there's really no reason to suggest that these events have led to Rapid Response or the city rethinking some of the approach here.
What do you hope that readers and listeners get from this story?
Well, I think there's really a lot here. You know, I mean, I think the argument itself is something that will draw a lot of attention, because I think to most of us, the idea of just forgetting about something like a wrongful death lawsuit is a pretty extraordinary idea. And I think, you know, that you could forget about something like this and that's why you get a do-over. Again, I think publicly is something that people are going to find to be strange, you know. So, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I do think, you know, like your question highlights, these, you know, these events are, you know, according at least to the complaints of the plaintiffs in these cases, are really the result of you know, either bad policies or bad enforcement of those policies, you know, lack of accountability for rapid response. And, you know, that this is, I think when we're talking about folks on the streets, we're talking about a group of people who are under-resourced, who already lack trust for law enforcement and attorneys and city offices. So, you know, I mean, I think it is worth keeping in mind that, you know, maybe not to like the level that this complaint alleges, but certainly, again, as reported last week, concerns around whether policies are being followed correctly or whether or not those policies should be in place to the extent that they currently are being followed. I think that's the real question that comes from stories like this. And I think it's one that, you know, the public and the city have to decide if this is really the best way to be handling encampments and storage and things like that.
Where can folks find a copy for themselves?
Yeah, I would suggest going and finding a vendor in your neighborhood and grab a copy. The story can explain this much better than I can, but aside from that, if you can't afford it or you're not local to Portland, you can definitely read it on our website at streetroots.org. All of our stories are published there for free.
Well, thank you so much, Kay. I appreciate you talking us through it.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, speaking with me about the newest article they co-authored for the paper. It's called A Tragic Comedy of Errors. Rapid Response BioClean asks court to set aside wrongful death lawsuit ruling, in part because its owner and attorney forgot about the case. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's county budget time in Multnomah County, the first that Chair Jessica Vega Peterson has been fully in charge of since winning her seat. There are some important things included in this budget and some important things left out. The process is going by quickly. A final vote on the budget is scheduled for June 6th. Last Wednesday, May 8th, was the first public hearing on the 2025 county budget. Here's Vega Peterson opening the floor for public comment.
Tonight's budget hearing is one way that Multnomah County collects community feedback on our budget before it will be adopted on Thursday, June 6th at the regular meeting of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. The FY25 executive budget is the first one I've had the privilege to lead from start to finish. It is an offering to our community and a reflection of where we're coming from, where we are, and where we're going. I am very proud of the values reflected in this budget.
One Multnomah County program that's been left out of this budget is the Multnomah Mothers Trust. It was a project started in 2021 offering unconditional cash transfers to African American mothers in the county. Payments of $500 started in May of 2022 to 100 Black mothers in need, but the latest county budget hasn't allocated for the program, meaning that as it stands, those payments, which were increased to $750 last summer, will end on July 1st. But let's back up a step. What is an unconditional cash transfer? It's a program that's aimed at reducing poverty by giving people money without any conditions on how it has to be used. At the Multnomah Mothers Trust, mothers in the program had the option to respond to a survey about how they used the money for an extra $50. The participants in the program weren't told how they had to spend the cash, and anecdotally, a lot of it was spent paying down debt or on basic needs. Many of the mothers in the program since 2022 have been able to create emergency funds or build their savings. Some have gone back to school, two were even able to purchase homes. I got the chance to speak with some of the mothers in the program about their experience in the trust and what it's meant to their lives. Loyalty Hustler is one of the mothers in the program. She says being a part of the Mothers Trust changed her life.
Being able to have the ability to not have to worry about whether or not if I can pay for my son to get his haircut or take it from my light bill money. So just kind of having that sense of alleviating that extra stress, being able to allow me to grow as an individual. You know, I've currently been in school and I've had to pick up extra shifts while I'm in school, which take time away from my studying. So it's allowed me to not have to strain myself more than I have to and work 10 times harder than I have to put my best foot forward to have the finances and also excel in school. So I've been able to chill on picking up overtime shifts and also being able to excel in my studies. So I'm grateful.
Keisha Kanda is another member of the trust. She says getting that $500 transfer meant a lot to her.
Being a single mother of three, living on one income, not having a partner, coming from domestic violence, don't have any child support, no food stamps, anything like that. So it was just my one income. And when it came in, I had a son who was going to a Catholic school, and so I had to pay scholarships for that as well. So it helped me a great deal just to be able to stay above the water, keep electricity, rent, and the bills, car insurance, and things taken care of without having to let my kids know the stress that I'm really under. So it not only helped me financially, but it helped me mentally as well. It took the stress, like I said, off of me mentally of not having the money.
LaFonda Grant was also in the trust. For her, the unconditional cash transfer meant breaking bad cycles.
It helped me break barriers and fears. It helped me break the cycle of debt that I found myself trapped in. It provided me with the means to invest in myself and my family by establishing an emergency fund and significantly reducing my school debt burden. Yes. The assistance from the Mothers Trust Fund has enabled me to make sustainable life changes, boosting my inner self-esteem and providing me with the confidence to strive for more. I no longer live in constant fear of financial instability or wage garnishment. You know, garnishing my check, I have to pay my bills. And when garnishing your check, it throws you off. And with the me not having to worry about that, the economic change period after COVID, you know, everything just went tripled. And I was stuck. I was like, what's going to happen? I can't afford this. Are we going to be homeless? I'm a mother of nine.
When it comes to the program being cut from the county budget, Hustler says it wasn't a shock to her.
Honestly, it wasn't surprising. And I just feel as being an African American in Portland, Oregon, everything has been taken from us. I'm pretty sure you may be aware of, you know, redlining and gentrification. And we don't even have a community we can call our own. So anything that is given or help us to succeed, it's never been something that stays. It's always taken from us, like life has always been taken from us.
What do you wish people knew about this program?
I wish people knew that it works, that women can grow from projects like this, that not just women, but all people can grow from projects like this. You know, I think our biggest worry is rent or the simple basic things in life. And if we just all was able to give this opportunity, the world would be a better place.
Candace says finding out the Multnomah Mothers Trust was being cut from the county budget in July hurt.
It hurt me because the people who are making the cuts aren't the people who are really living this life. So, you know, what do you say to a woman who's independent? Well, who became independent, got out of a terrible relationship that was, detrimental to me, my children, my health, my mental. What do you say to a woman who is leaving a situation like that and don't get child support, don't get food stamps? You know, you cut something like that. To me, it's devastating. Why are we cutting that? Let's not cut that. Let's find ways to maybe see where we can pull other money from and see how many other women we can help and put in this program.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at it, every woman that you will talk to from the Mother's Trust will have a story for you of empowerment, how it has impacted them a great deal. It's not, you know, the financial is amazing, but it's also about the mental and being a mother on your own and not having a lot and just being able to be blessed with that stipend every month to be able to just to continue to invest in your family. Yes, put a little money into savings. Yes, pay for your kids' schooling. I mean, kids are growing daily. They're growing daily. They have an appetite. So it's like the money is being spent the way it should be. It's like it's real. It's real out here. The money is being spent where it should be. And it was a blessing to be able to get it. I'm saddened because I want other women who are going through life like me, who are just trying to stay above water on their own, to be able to receive this help. It was amazing. And for it to end, I'm sad, but I'm very thankful and grateful to have received it.
Here's Grant again.
I wish they could feel the transformation like I did. And the experience with the support of the Mother's Trust Fund is a testament of the power and the impact of the community assistance. My journey from financial hardship to stability hopefully gives hope for other women who looks like me. Facing some of life's most difficult challenges, I would like to see the flame of hope with the Mother's Trust Fund ignite and continue to burn brightly, because we need this. Just that little bit of help goes a long way. A long way.
I just wish that anybody, before you make such a serious decision on cutting funds, that you maybe, you know, just come out of that office, come out of that chair one day and come down and meet the people that you are impacting.
Exactly.
Come meet them. Come see what their life is about. Come see the struggles that they go through. Come see the strides that we are making.
Mm-hmm.
Come see what we're actually doing. We you know, the women in the program, we're mighty. We're making moves, you know.
Yes.
Every woman that I know that has got this Mother's Trust,
has excelled from it.
Has excelled. Like I said, we empower. We go down to the state capitol. We are trying to make changes for the women, our community, our children, you know, the people in front of us, the people behind us, on our sides, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. We got to realize and just try to do our best for the people who are going through it. You know, they're just as important as anybody else. And once we give them the opportunity to excel, they're going to excel. But you just have to put the power behind it. And with this fund being cut, it's just sad to me. Yeah. Nobody came down and asked. Nobody asked me how it's impacted me. Nobody asked me how amazing it was, what it did to me financially, mentally, and wholly for my family. Nobody. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how something can be cut when you haven't even met the people that it has impacted. I don't understand it.
When early results of the program were reported back to the County Commission in November 2022, commissioners were enthusiastic about the results and what they reflected on the county. They even spoke about finding additional funding streams to support more mothers in the future. Commissioner Lori Stegman is quoted as saying, "I just want to say how proud I am of Multnomah County always being on the cutting edge of doing things outside the box. You are all perfect examples of that," end quote. The county commissioners will vote on the proposed Multnomah County budget on June 6th. On the chopping block is the Multnomah Mothers Trust, a program that gives 100 African American mothers in the county an unconditional cash transfer of $750 each month. I spoke with three mothers in the trust for this piece, Loyalty Hustler, LaFonda Grant, and Keisha Kanda. For KBU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding